In the Civil War, a national conflict was felt at the family level. Cousin fought against cousin, and brother against brother. In this way, larger disputes come down to a personal level that embroil us and our loved ones. In our second story for the program, Drew Jacoby Sangor tells us the story of a divine divide in his family and his attempt to overcome it.
Right now, I'm headed home. It's a Friday afternoon, and my dad's driven 3 hours in rush hour traffic to come pick me up from school in Palo Alto. I haven't been home from college in 3 months, but it seems fitting that I'm headed there, because I guess home is where this story actually starts. At home last summer, I broke up with my girlfriend, Lisa. Don't worry, this isn't a sob story about a romance gone bad. There were no melodramatic soap opera portrayals, no tabloid news coverage. But 3 months after the breakup, she said something that would change everything for me. Amidst the awkwardness entitled to ex-couples, we were laughing uncomfortably at each other's jokes when Lisa, half-whispering, told me that she had realized she needed someone in a relationship who could share her love for God with her. What I was hearing from Lisa was that in some important way, religion had been a dividing factor in our relationship. As you can probably guess, Lisa is a strongly religious girl who comes from a tight and cheerily devout Christian family. Me? Well, I'm not any of those things. First of all, I'm atheist. What is amazing is that the entire time we were together, we had never talked about this stuff. I think we were afraid of what might happen if we did. So we had shied away from religion, hoping that it would never come up. But obviously, it never went away.
Don't you know that I'll be around to guide you?
After her revelation, as I watched news stories about the arguments over the place of religious values in Bush's re-election, I was surprised by how upset I was made by the inability of Americans to have a productive conversation about religion. But all my life, I had been having the exact same problem. I realized that I had never had a conversation about religion with my parents either. Like Lisa and I, my mom is religious and my dad is atheist. And you see, my parents' relationship went bad. I mean, biblical proportions bad. The most memorable moments are a highlight reel consisting of swearing, arguments in the street, and a tricycle my mom threw at my dad's car once. They never married, and the three of us never lived in the same house. With me and Lisa, it seemed like I had fallen into the same trap they had, that the divide had just been too vast to bridge. After 20 years of knowing my parents, I needed to find out what I had never thought to explore with them before. Why had my parents never talked to me about their beliefs? And why had they never taken the care to hand them down to me? I hoped that answers to these questions might help me understand why, apparently, Lisa and I would never have been able to make it work. And so here I am now, riding shotgun as my dad fights rush hour traffic, headed home to make things clear.
Cast some light and be alright.
The first thing I wanted to know was how my parents had even come to believe what they did. Hopefully, this would help me understand the importance of religion in their lives. And if I could understand that, then maybe I'd be able to understand the importance of religion in their relationship together, and to pinpoint where everything went wrong. I went to my mom's house and spoke with her first. We sat on a futon in a tidy green-walled bedroom, as she told me about how she had grown up in a Catholic family, went to Catholic school, went to church, the whole package. All things I already knew, though. But then, she started telling me a story I had never heard before. She started telling me about the order of the children. As a Catholic schoolgirl, my mom had decided she was going to be a nun, and so set out to do so.
I was fortunate enough to have my sister and my cousin, who were 2 years younger than I was, and they went to the same school. So luckily, they shared the same desire to have this calling. So I said, okay, we're going to start our own order. We're going to be you know, we're going to be the order of the children, and this is what our habits are going to be. These outfits that my mother had bought for us, it was, you know, warm, it was late in the school year, and they were called skorts, and basically what they were little t-shirts, and then little short shorts.
They even set up an altar in the bedroom and performed communion with Necco wafers. But as it turns out, my mom didn't last that long as a nun.
What I found was that you had to wash the skorts, you know. You had to take them off and you had to put them in the washing machine and you had to put on a pair of jeans or a pair of shorts and, you know, then what do you do? You know, you can't go in and pray. You got to go outside. And it just seemed like there wasn't a heck of a lot happening in that corner of my bedroom, but there was a hell of a lot happening outside in the neighborhood. Pretty soon, the world just sucked us in like a Hoover. And the skorts, you know, they just weren't in fashion anymore. I mean, you know, hey, man, I'm not wearing those. Nobody's wearing those anymore. But religion was, it was like breathing.
Even though my mom gave up her ambitions of being a nun, this story still said something about the strength of her beliefs. Beliefs that I would later find had factored heavily into my parents' division. Beliefs she still holds today, but had never before expressed to me. On the other side of things, my dad's childhood story of spiritual decision-making was far different. Back at his house, we sit in an office littered with books and with the door closed, and he starts to tell me his story. Having saved his money from working all summer, shining shoes, and cleaning out lockers at the nearby Alameda Naval Base, my dad, who was 13 at the time and headed into high school, bought himself a brand new Letterman jacket for track. But that same day he bought it, it was stolen. And so he went home looking for comfort from his mother.
First thing she did was, what? You lost that? She broke out the extension cord. And she was going to whip me. And I just told her, I said, it's wrong. I said, it's my loss. It's my money. I work for it. You don't have to buy me anything. Why are you beating me? And all she said was, get down. And I looked at her and said, it's wrong. It's unfair. And I won't. And I took off.
He ran to the local reverend's house, pleading with him for help. But all he did was call my dad's mother to tell her to pick him up.
My mother came down with her extension cord in her hand. In her hand. And this man of God watched her practically rip me from his house. You know, and I'm screaming at the top of my voice. You know, I was outraged. This was so unfair.
So he took off yet again. But this time, his mom was in hot pursuit.
The housing project was boxed in with about a 6-foot fence, and so I'm cutting between, and I'm looking around, Mama's right back behind me, right? So the 6-foot fence comes up, and I hit that fence. It was like left foot, right foot over, and I'm over the fence, and I'm still tracking because, you know, I want some distance between me and her, and I'm just pausing just a little bit, you know, and what do I see? I see this woman, her skirt up over her legs, coming over the fence, and I just say, oh.
Still running, my dad reached the barbed wire fence surrounding the military base and saw that he was running out of options.
And I know what my last chance is. And I literally take my sweatshirt off as I'm running, you know, and I wrap it around me. And I hit that barbed wire fence, and I throw myself on the other side, and I don't run anymore. I just stand, because I've got nothing left. And I'm standing there, and I'm looking at my mother. She runs up, and I'm looking, and I'm breathing hard. And we're just looking at each other. Your butt gonna have to come home sometime. That's what she said. That's what she said. So I ended up sleeping that night underneath the bleachers. God didn't help me. and I was about as innocent as you come. God is supposed to be there to protect the innocent. That's what I hear in school, you know, children of the innocent. Now, what do I need a God if he's going to let me be beaten and I've done nothing? What do I need a God for? Hell, I can take care of myself.
These two stories from my parents revealed just how important and deeply seated their beliefs were. But it only confused the issue of why they had kept from sharing them with me. If these experiences had really been such influential episodes in their lives, why weren't they important enough to talk about? Shouldn't beliefs this strong have been front and center in the relationships between the three of us? There must have been a decision that my parents made somewhere along the way, where they agreed that those very values and beliefs which were rooted in those childhood stories needed to be hidden away and pushed into the background like bad memories. I asked my mom if this was the case, and she finally began to shed some light in this direction.
There was an essential, deep chasm between your father and I that we struggled to bridge, never doing a good job, and then we finally just stopped communicating, and you just became the one thing that we had in common. So the whole thing, for me at that time, when this the question of faith, came up, was that I wanted to avoid your father at all costs. I wanted to avoid the conflict at all costs.
I just didn't want her to not give you an option. And she has her own need. She has her own seeking after something. And that need may not be yours. And my concern was that you should not be indoctrinated.
So I made the choice to go toward avoidance rather than toward what my values were, because I knew that we weren't, strong enough and weren't, evolved enough in our relationship to have a dialogue about it.
Give me your hand.
Here it was. This was the exact reason I had been looking for. It was not that my parents had decided they would not discuss their beliefs with me. The fundamental problem was that they had been completely unable and afraid to. On the way back to school, at the end of my weekend at home, I thought about how the situation my parents had put themselves in was not much different from my relationship with Lisa. Though our relationship was never hostile like my parents had been, I was troubled to think that it may have nonetheless been headed in that direction. Our inability to talk about our beliefs would no doubt have caught up with us sooner or later. With this on my mind, I decided to talk to someone who would be able to tell me just how common of an issue this is for couples. Someone who could give me some idea of how to make a relationship work when the people in it have drastically different beliefs.
There are a lot of situations across this country where one party in a marriage will be quite religious and the other will have either no religious background at all or will be virulently anti-religious or would say they're agnostic. So it's pretty common.
This is Reverend Scotty McLennan, the Dean of Religious Life at Stanford University. I've gone to meet with him at his office inside Memorial Church, the large cathedral on the Stanford campus. McLennan pointed out that in addition to communication, respect and empathy are essential for uniting people in a relationship who realize that their foundational beliefs may not be identical.
So there are families that are tragically torn apart because of differences in religion. I think it's more an issue when you realize that somebody's religious faith is very strong and very central to their worldview, to their way of acting, to their ethics, to their sense of what it means to be a family. Then you've got an issue that might be similar in many ways to people from very different cultural backgrounds. How do you relate to somebody who doesn't have your understanding of the world? How do you work it out in such a way that you have empathy in your relationship? and you're genuinely respectful of each other.
The importance of respect that Reverend McLennan stressed made me realize that for discussion to be effective in preserving a relationship, it needed to be meaningful. I remember moments in my childhood when my parents exchanged words, many of which consisted of four letters, or screamed, or even both. And there was no surprise in the fact that resolutions and common ground were never discovered. The thing is, this common ground was never really sought after. In order to further illustrate his point, McLennan stated that this problem within a family is very similar to what is happening in America politically. He confirmed what I had originally discovered as I sat on the couch watching the evening news about the red and blue states, that America itself was becoming divided over differences in religious beliefs, just as my parents and my relationship had been.
These are dangerous times, and these are risky times, and religion has always been a double-edged sword. All of the great prophets and teachers and so on have spoken on the one hand about peace and about unity and about harmony, and on the other hand have scriptural references and statements that are us-they kinds of statements and which tend to divide, and that's very much what's going on at this time in history.
The problems characteristic of this time in history were strikingly similar to the problems I had seen between my mom and dad and Lisa and I. Those beliefs we hold the tightest have come to be seen as our most dangerous topic of discussion. During the election just last fall, tens of millions of people shattered the possibility of dialogue as they stepped all too eagerly into the fiercely oppositional categories of the religious right and secular left. The analogy between the personal and the political is far from perfect, but it seems to reveal that much of the political division and religious polarization in America has been created by a lack of meaningful discussion. As those us-they statements that McLennan mentioned have become more and more common, national dialogue has become increasingly futile. The beliefs that each of us hold have become our greatest obstacle to national unity. But it doesn't have to be this way. That's one more thing I've learned from my parents' conflicts. You see, the story of my mom and dad's relationship doesn't end with scream curses and a tricycle soaring through the air. Amazingly, over the course of my lifetime, my parents have come to be close friends. What they had to do to make this improbable friendship work was discover that they had something in common which their feud compromised. That thing was me. I've come to think that this is what America as a whole needs as well. Those beliefs we hold the tightest have to be addressed because they don't just go away. Avoiding discussion only puts at risk those essential connections we actually share. I can't say that I know the answer, but what I can say is that if our country can find that thing we have in common that is in jeopardy, that thing that is at stake for all of us, we may finally see that we don't have to agree on religion. If we can only come to recognize those values that bind us together. If we can do this, then I believe dialogue will finally be possible. For Lisa and I, the discussion over our beliefs has finally become possible, and our relationship has transitioned into friendship. For us, that thing we saw at stake was being there for each other. Though we may see now that we want different things, I believe this ability to communicate our deepest values has made it possible for our friendship to thrive where our romantic relationship fell short. In the case of my parents, I believe they finally found that common ground which was in such desperate need of tread. And in doing so, they found that behind all their initial differences, those things that they felt to be the most meaningful and important in life were the same. I've made no drastic religious conversion since going through this 6-month process, but I have gained something. This resolution that my parents have reached is something that I've come to find comfort in. Now when my parents and I go out to dinner together, and instead of battling about their differences, they can joke affectionately about each other's quirks, I sit smiling at the hope their seasoned relationship radiates. What Reverend McLennan said is true. If we're to bridge the divides between us, meaningful conversations about what is important to each of us are essential. Yet even though I know it will take America as a whole that much longer, I still believe it's possible. Because I found that if I can believe in my parents, I can believe in anything.
Drew Jacoby Sangor is a recent graduate of Stanford University.